Blog Talk Radio.
Hi everybody, it's Mark here. Thanks for tuning in and or listening to the recording. And well, this particular chat is a biggie for me. For those of people who are familiar with the Ice Cream for the Soul chat, they quite often hear me talk about Muji. And eventually I managed to get to speak to him, so I was really, really excited. And I was also a little nervous, which you may hear, and I actually confessed to Muji as well as I spoke to him. And also, there's, as well as being a biggie for me getting to chat with Muji, this is like 2 years now since I started having these conversations. And I've had some amazing conversations with some amazing people. I've also asked the occasional silly question here and there and come out with a silly comment. Well, that's, and I'm not worried too much about that these days. It's just part of who I am. And I just want to say thanks. A heartfelt thanks to everybody who's been part of the Ice Cream for the Soul of the last 2 years. It's been really has been an amazing journey for me, and I've had some amazing feedback from people who have been really touched by the conversations that I've been having. And for those who are new to the Ice Cream for the Soul, I predominantly interview three principles facilitators. You'll hear me talk about the three principles in the conversation with Muji. Three principles psychology is having an amazing impact around the world. And if you would like to find out more, there's lots of stuff going on, but myself and Sheila Massand and Sue Pankovic, we're organising a Viva event here in Spain. That's 14th to the 16th of November. So I've put a link on this to that. If you're just curious what this is about, if you don't know about three principles, then just check out the website there. Next week, I'll get on with the conversation in a minute. I'll be speaking to the person who was my very first guest on the show, and that was Gabriela Maldonado Montano. She's a beautiful, wise, intelligent woman, and I look forward to, and she's great fun as well, and she's actually going to be one of the speakers at the Viva event, so I look forward to speaking with her too. So I'll shut up. Oh, no, I won't. Just one more thing. If you want to contact me on Facebook via Yoga Mark, or email me at satya.yoga@hotmail.es. I've been having trouble with the Ice Cream for the Soul emails for some reason. So, and again, satya.yoga, that's on the information here as well, if you want to check that out. And all the previous shows are available on www.icecreamforthesoul.com. Icecreamforthesoul, that's my website, sorry. Okay, I'll shut up and I'll play the conversation that I had with Muji. And this was at Monte Sarraj in Portugal in August. I'm deliberately leaving in the beginning part where I'm explaining to Muji who I'm, what I am. That's mainly for people perhaps who are not familiar with who I am and what I do. So that's enough of me waffling, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. Thanks again for tuning in.
Very good.
Mm-hmm. Would you like me to just give you a little background?
It's good.
A few years ago, my partner dragged me along. My partner, she's a coach.
Yeah.
And she's very much into personal development. And I got dragged along to an event where a psychologist speaking about the mind. And I thought we was going on an event that was, the Law of Attraction event. Mm-hmm. Manifestation. Mm-hmm. If you think right, you'll get your Ferrari and all this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas suddenly the conversation turned to, we're talking about innate health, that there's, you've all got innate health. And then from that moment, I had, not that exact moment, I was very intrigued what was being said. And it was coming from a very psychological, something called the three principles psychology. It's coming from a very psychological aspect. But I had a very profound insight, which suddenly, I'd been seeing your clips on YouTube, but they didn't mean anything to me. And then I'd had this insight, and then suddenly I could hear you.
Ah, I see.
And then this was around 5 years ago, and about 2 years ago I started interviewing people. It's part more of a hobby of mine. I interview people, psychologists who are pointing to innate health. They're not trying to fix people's problems. They're not interested in the problems and the stories. Very much like you, they're pointing them back to the self. But the terminology is different.
Different, but yes.
So from that moment on, it's just been a passion of mine to interview and just put them out there for free. And a lot of the people who tune in are people helpers who are working in prisons, addiction centres, mental health places, things like that.
So it's nice.
And I know a lot of them, the three principles of psychology, a lot of your videos turn up on these sites. Especially when you're talking about thought. So I know this will be appreciated by the...
Okay, good. It's good to have a bit of background. It's good.
Okay.
Listen. Yes.
I'm not used to doing it with the camera, sorry.
No, don't worry about the camera at all. No, it's okay.
It's Mark Jones here with the Ice Cream for the Soul Blog Talk Radio Show. And this week I feel blessed to be speaking to somebody. When I started the show over 2 years ago, I had it in mind that I would really like to speak to a certain man. And that's actually happening now. And I'm talking with Moochie.
Yeah.
And I'm here at Monte Sahaj at the retreat. And it was a bit of a nightmare getting here, actually. At one point, I didn't think I was going to get here. Some people who are friends of mine on Facebook will know that I bought a motorbike to come down from my home in Spain. So it was a 10-hour ride. It's part of the adventure of coming to Monte Sahaj to the retreat. Mm-hmm. But halfway here, the motorbike blew up, basically. Well, it didn't blow up. But I've learned what it's going to cost to fix. It may as well have blown up.
Mm-hmm.
So I arrived 2 days late for the retreat. I set off on the Tuesday and I didn't actually get here till Friday morning. And I was still at the very first satsang. I was still quite busy in my mind. I was so pleased to be here, but I was quite busy in my mind. And then I went down after the first satsang. I went down to the Sangha shop.
Mm-hmm.
And quite by surprise, I turned around and Moochie had walked in the shop. And I was immediately, it was probably the first moment time I'd relaxed in those previous 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so pleased that I'd come, because at one point I nearly went home. Mm-hmm. I nearly abandoned the old mission. So I'm so pleased to be here speaking to you, Moochie.
Thank you.
I really
I'm very happy.
Your time. And well, I mentioned to Moochie just a moment ago that I came across your teachings in many ways I was brought to it by a psychology, which I'd imagine in some ways you'd be pleased to hear that, rather than... I didn't necessarily come by the normal spiritual routes.
Yeah, no.
I actually heard something that's being taught to people in psychology now. Not all psychology, but there's a certain amount of psychologists who have woken up to a teacher. There's a man named Cindy Banks who had a realization, and he began to talk to psychologists, and he told them to stop pointing people to the stories and to the problems, and instead point them to their innate health. Now, when I hear you speak, like you're incessantly, relentlessly pointing people to what you refer to as the self.
Yes.
And you're also often as well in the three principles psychology, people, they talk a lot about thought, and we're not our thoughts. I was just wondering if you'd like to just, if you could, on, if from a psychological point. I'm sure you can totally see how in psychology when people are just pointing to the stories all the time and saying, oh, poor me, about this, that and the other.
There's
an aspect of us that's unchanging.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if you'd like to talk to that.
Yes, from what I picked up from you know, your talk so far is I feel that people, they can't help it, actually, because we are brought up to believe that we are our body. We are, well, basically our conditioning. We're basically, the examples we see around us help to confirm that, because everyone relates on the basis that they are their body and that they are their conditioning, belief, and so on. No? So it is just so entrenched in us from early age that when we say I, that is really our personality, our person, and so on. And it seems in the whole of life, no area of human life seem to question that. Once we come from that perspective, you know, that this is me, I'm John Brown, you know, I'm 5'7" tall, I'm married with 2 children, I live in this place, and I like this and I don't like this, I believe in this and I don't believe in that, and so on. And it seems like when you present yourself like that, nobody really questions it. They just begin to question, perhaps, you know, your views about other things. But about yourself, no one questions, because they themselves also assume that they are their bodies and their thoughts are their facts, in a sense. And life, is in its wisdom, puts us together to show that in different bodies, a different system of thought can seem to be very striking and very true, you know. And then that comes into contact with another point of consciousness, where a different structure is there, a different belief system, and so on. And that is also very strongly believed in. And by putting us together, whether it is in a house, or in a small community, or in a town, or a city, or whatever it is, we have to keep being challenged as to whether our thoughts are the facts that we think they are. And oftentimes we express opinions and so on like that, and with a strength of belief and vigor that seem to come across as though they are certainties. And then we are constantly meeting people who have different views and who equally are, you know, confident in their views and so on. And I think this kind of mixture help to us to question, rather than being questioned by directly like that. But we question whether our views are that totally true. And sometimes you meet people whose views are much clearer than yours, and we just inherit those views and drop the old views. So it is a matrix of this interrelated, contacts and so on. But no one seemed to, for a very long time, question the premise that, you know, I am this body. I am a man or a woman, and this is the age of the body. It's on my birth certificate and so on. And these form the fundamental of who I will present myself to be in this life, you see. But we cannot be our thoughts. We cannot be our thoughts. First of all, I put it that whatever you can perceive, you cannot be that thing. Whatever you can, whether it's thoughts, feelings, sensation, memory, or any other thing that we may like or dislike, because they are merely a sort of an object in perception. It's an object, something that we see. And it comes in focus and goes out of focus. It arises and it disappears. But you are there to watch that. So if you were that thing, then when it goes, which they do, you would also be gone. But you're here to witness its coming and its going. So you must stand apart from the things that you perceive, however passionately you might feel about it. And that is a fact that is completely irrefutable, you know. We have to stand on that common ground that whatever your belief systems are, they may feel very intimate, but you can change your beliefs. And you have not changed yourself fundamentally. It may affect your behavior, but your fundamental nature must be the same, because you know you're that which is aware of beliefs. You're aware even, I would say, of knowledge, and you're aware of ignorance also. So you must somehow stand apart from them. I can continue, actually, and I'd like to say like this, because if we say you're able to judge, for instance, if your eyesight is not perfect in both eyes, and you're talking to an optician in your first counsel, your first session with them, and they may ask you what's wrong, and you can say, well, actually, I feel that the sight in my left eye is functioning about 70%, but in my right eye, it's just like 40%.
Yeah.
So there's something that's behind and separate from sight that can even observe. It sees sight, and it sees even seeing. But we're really questioned in that. So it seems very subtle thing to be aware of it, you know?
Yeah.
And very rarely we would have to speak like that.
Yeah.
But we do speak like that. We do say, you know, my memory is fading. It's not as good as it used to be.
Yeah.
So there's something that's aware of memory. And the strength of memory, the strength of the functioning of memory, it knows that the memory is not up to scratch or something. It can look also and say that, you know, my breathing, you know, is these days more slower and heavier or something.
Yeah.
So it is not the breathing, it is observing the breathing.
Yeah.
You say also, my ego. I used to have a much bigger ego. And I feel that my ego has really, really shrunk over the last few years because of some experiences I've had or something. So it is not the ego. Something is also aware of ego, at least to some extent.
Yeah.
It's also able to say that my intellectual power was much stronger when I was in my early 30s than it is now. My power to discriminate, you know, really sort of like sharply, that's been blunted now. So it cannot be intellect also. It is commenting about intellect. It is aware of these things. It says, you can say, you know, I used to believe in so-and-so, but I don't anymore. So it is not belief also. It is aware of belief.
Yeah.
So this is aware, which is aware of all these things, which are so intimate to the human sense of self, can be seen that there is a force or a space in us from where the observing of these forces take place.
Mm.
But yet no one researches this, you know.
Yeah.
We always start from the position of the person, and we can speak about our person too. We can be aware of our person too.
Mm.
You know, we are aware that when we are being very compassionate, or when we are full of judgments, or when we are full of ego, we're aware that we have a strong sense of self, and when we are stubborn, we know all this. Something is behind that knows and is aware of all these things.
Many of us are just so glued to the thoughts that they arise, or and the beliefs that they arise, aren't we?
Yes, yes.
For example, I think I heard you say once, like somebody may walk in a room and they have the thought that person doesn't like them.
Yes.
And straight away they get into an attitude.
Yes.
And it's just total thought on earth.
I found a link to that, because I feel that as if our sense of identity is not questioned, then it is like it slowly tightens up into what is perceived as a fact.
Mm.
So it's like you just some people would cannot take any questioning about themselves.
Yeah.
They feel very strongly that they're who they think they are. You see, and the more you don't question this, the more bigoted we can become, the more insular, the more myopic, meaning that you can't see outside of your own mind at all, you know. And you may hear other people's views, but you always look at that as that you're looking down at it or you're looking at it as something, it doesn't really impact on you very deeply.
No. People come very close, don't they?
And that is coming out of an identity that has not really been questioned. The more that we feel very strongly that, you know, I am who I say I am, the more we are going to be, there's little gap because we have not developed this, the ability to observe without identity.
Yeah.
When we begin to observe, and sometimes we have to be taught that, because in our general run of life, no one comes to you and say, you know, listen, you can, or it might be hinted at, but not sufficiently to break the tidal wave of conditioning.
Mm.
So whichever way it comes, when it is being introduced, that, you know, you can begin to just observe something rather than just go with the reflex to identify. And even if the reflex is strong, there is an awareness of that taking place. And if you just begin to acknowledge that or try to recognize that, this space will keep opening up. And as the space opens up between what you are perceiving and you, the perceiver, you'll find that internally there's a sense of expansiveness. Life slows down from the kind of speed that sometimes our mind, because if your mind is speedy, then your life is speedy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, somehow with observing, there is a kind of slowing down. There's a way of, it's almost though, as though your way of looking becomes much more panoramic.
Mm.
and less fearful, because you're aware that you're observing something as a phenomenon, and that which is observing is not the person, because the person also can be observed.
Mm.
You know, or the personal belief system, yeah, or the kind of vibration of a person, because we do very much read each other on vibration,
yeah,
whether we like it or not, you know?
I used to think, yeah, that was a load of hippie nonsense.
Yes.
Now I just see it so clearly.
Yes, because
energetic things.
Energetic very, very much, whether we like the word or not. You know, sometimes you're sitting in a room and somebody comes inside that room, say maybe it might be a cafe or someplace you're sitting, and somebody comes in and you definitely feel a strong sense of uneasiness. They may not speak anything, they may not act in any way that is so, you know, so loud, but some vibration is felt, something is felt, and whether you want to call it vibration or you want to call it, you know, you're sort of like a kind of psychic smell or something, you know, I just don't like the feel of this guy or whatever it is, and because we do wear those energies, and if they're strong in us, it is part of the language that we are not so... We are not so accustomed to using this like this, but we do respond on that level. And so when you have that strong, if you have strong belief in a certain thing, or you're very narrow-minded, it comes across in people when they're relating to you that they have to watch what they say, because, you know, you're going to chop them quickly, or you're going to, you know, and that's a vibration that you know. So the more that there are people who become aware of observing, the more there is space in you, the less sense of threat there is, the more you can listen without reacting, without, you know, snap, but just listen and allow someone to complete a sentence, even that you already, something inside already starts to react to, you can watch that reaction also. So this is a power that is underrated, and for the most part we're unconscious of it, we're not aware of it. But when we begin to learn just to observe with some detachment, then you're coming into a much more impersonal way of perceiving life or beings around us. When that develops more, because you will begin to like that,
yeah,
it feels much more healthy. It feels really authentic. It's kind, actually.
Yeah.
And not aggressive. The more you observe, the more you see that life is not the threat that you may have thought it was when we are very much in our mind, yeah, very much in our story, very much in, you know, my way of looking at things, mm-hmm, and like that.
Yeah.
So So I found that that was one of the first great steps for many people, is being shown the way into observing with some detachment, you know.
Now, the next question that comes to mind, because I was dragged along to a yoga class by my partner, kicking and screaming. I always make this joke because I saw it as being very a girly pastime, you know,
in my
male ego and ignorance. But I was quite surprised. I initially went because I had a bad back. I'm a gardener by my trade as a gardener, so after years of gardening, my back was suffering. But I was really surprised. I got really into it. And the very first time my yoga teacher asked me, till I was 37, I think, at this time, my yoga teacher said, "Oh, lie on your mat and let your mind become quiet." I was like, okay. And that was the first time I saw the busyness of the mind. Anyway, I'm drifting now, sorry.
No. You're right, no? Yeah.
And I became intrigued more and more by the yoga. So I asked for yoga books for Christmas. And I wanted mainly books on the asanas, but I got a lot of Eastern philosophical stuff came up. I thought, oh, what's this, you know? And I couldn't. There's so much wisdom in the books. I think the first thing that impacted me, and I can get quite emotional as I say, it was everybody is welcome in the yoga shala. Doesn't matter what nationality, what religion, everybody is welcome.
Mm-hmm.
And that struck me, because I always thought it was a bit of religious. I thought it was a religious aspect. And there was so much wisdom about love and compassion. And then there was the talking about the person and the ego and observing.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that was just, I had no idea what they were talking about. And then I had an insight around it, like I said before the interview, which many people who listen to the show have heard me, I bore people with it every week about my insights that I've had. Mm-hmm. But then it became the most interesting thing to me. Whereas to the average man in the street or the average person in the street, if you suggest, I have friends, for example, who are they're suffering in relationships or work or one thing or another, and I ask them to just observe their thoughts. And they look at me as if to say, they don't even stop. They see no value in that. And of course, you and I both know this. Immense value, even I, from my limited understanding and perspective. So it's how do we get people to I see that's what you're doing all the time. You're helping people and guiding people. But it seems the hardest thing seems to be how to get people interested in that.
That's true, yeah. In the early days, I used to try and do that. And I found that it was very difficult.
Yes.
Because I don't know what it is about trying. People feel like you're trying to convert them to something or, you know, kind of like, and they're not ready for it. So it does take some something. What I have found is that when I'm not interested to talk about it, then it's like something in your presence is just so quiet because you have no intention. That's a very powerful thing, because most people have intention. You understand? If you don't have intention, then what it happens is that there's such a peace in you that something in them is drawn to find out what's with this guy. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Because like, I'm waiting for you to make a move, and you ain't making a move. So like, well, you know what I mean? Like, you know, you don't seem like you know. So they are curious, and they may approach you and say, you know, like, you know, say, are you some kind of this or are you some kind of that? And I would just deny it flatly, basically. You know, I said, no, I'm just I don't know, I'm just here, man. You know, and if they are, because I don't want them to be interested or not want them to be interested.
Yeah.
Because you're just in this state, and then what happens is that they have to persist. The more that they didn't get the answer that their mind wants quickly, because if I say, yeah, I'm a yoga teacher, or you know, I train people in whatever it is, they go, oh, okay, yeah, it's just really good, you know, yeah, I do some of that sometime, and it's gone,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
But you don't feed into that at all, you know. And so what if what happens is it helps them to dig more deeply because something is fascinated, you know, deeper than their usual mind. Like something is like, you know, like, you know, there's something about this guy, you know. And, you know, but I don't know what it is. And so, and it's not just mind. It's not just their mind. It's more going down into a soul place. Yeah, just, you know, yeah. And they may not be comfortable about it, but some of the curiosity is there. And when they get to a place where the questions are touched by that, then you'll find it's easier to say something to them.
Yeah.
Because then it can be, you know, you know, it's like you've got a space to speak with them.
Yeah.
That has been one of the most important things if you're starting from scratch with people. And if it's people who have known you for a while, they must have noticed something about you. They must have noticed that, wait, you know, like, you know, exchange a bit. But you know what? It's kind of like a bit cool, you know, and there would be, you know, sort of like this. And but there's also some fear. There's always fear of the unknown for people.
Yeah.
They don't as yet realize that everything is unknown. They and that they're just comfortable in the apparent known. They don't, you know, because really, when you, the more deeply you go, the more you realize that I don't really know. I mean, when I talk about I know this, but at a deeper level, there's a confession that comes from your soul. I don't really know this, you know, and that there's no shame in that. It's almost that there's a space in not knowing, and there's a lesser space in apparent knowing, and that apparent knowing comes with a lot of tension because you have to kind of prove that you know, whereas when you don't know, you have nothing to defend. You're just here. And there's a silence about it, you see? So in the beginning, I had a very strong feeling at one time that I would like to meet with some people. I used to sit after I stopped teaching at college. I left teaching and I used to find myself in the center of Brixton, sitting around and just, I don't know, just sitting. I was not thinking or directing my day. I would find myself under a tree or in the park or having a coffee in a restaurant or something. And I found then that I wanted to connect with people at a certain point. I wanted because I felt I had something to share. So I started to, sometimes I'd meet some people who'd have been drinking a bit and stuff. And I felt like, man, that's a very sad, because I could see them going down, you know. And I'd say this, you know, like, hey, Johnny, why don't you come and sit with me sometime and we just have a cup of tea? And he goes, yeah, I'm coming. A demonstration of what I was talking about before. It wasn't working like that for me. When something relaxed, like for instance now, I don't try and attract people to this. It goes by itself in some way.
Yeah.
But in those times, I really felt I wanted to have this exchange of meeting people. I felt there was going to come people who had really felt that heart connection with them. And then I knew that our conversations would just emerge somehow. I didn't have a line of conversation. It was just inside my heart, it was just a fire. It was not a book. It was just like a fire. And I felt like I wanted to, that connecting with someone, with someone in that level, was just going to be something magical, you know? But it took quite a while, actually, you know?
I'm reminded of what a lot of the facilitators of the three principles talk about is deep listening.
Yeah.
For example, they get clients coming who just want to offload all their problems, and initially where they'd be dissecting every single problem. Now they're just told to listen. The trick is to listen, and they'll know when to say something. And it's a skill I'm still developing, because I still quite often want to jump in too soon when I'm talking to friends, for example. I don't facilitate as much. This is what I do. I interview people who are helping people. This is what my passion is. But when I'm helping friends, it's something I'm noticing more and more, whereas the more quiet I can get without letting my
enthusiasm
want to help them, there's something will arise that will just point them back to themselves.
Yeah.
And I was just hearing that very much in what you were saying.
It is very much like that, because initially when we're listening with our person have many things, maybe sometimes some saved up examples and things like that. It just wants to, now is a chance to kind of do this. But it really isn't in communion at all at that moment. Mm. It is just kind of, it's in a still a state of immaturity, and it just wants to interject and say, yeah, but did you hear about this?
Yeah.
But that's not appropriate at a soul level for this type of conversing, you see?
Mm.
So this deep listening, it also comes together with observing.
Yeah.
And they're not dissimilar, and there's something there. And the deep listening is, for me, just being in a state of presence.
Yeah.
It is a state of presence. At a later stage, you may even find that you're not really listening at all. You know, when the trust is completely there, maybe the person is just speaking gibberish, and it's not that you actually have got to listen and wait until, now I need to say something. It's almost like automatically it just becomes brighter, and something says, could you hang on a second there for a moment?
Mm.
You said something here just now, and I would just like you to say what that was again.
Yeah.
And they reversed back a bit and picked it up and listened in. So, okay, in that moment, okay, when you said that, where were you inside yourself when you said that? And then it was like, wow, it's like this. Because that's coming not from the mind and not from saved up knowledge,
no.
Not even from experience. It's coming from the self, from that place that I speak about,
you see?
Yeah. And it sort of... I'm using the word knows, but it's so fresh, that it doesn't have to follow the law of language or the principles of language. It's just like a combination that just finds the right combination to unlock something like that. It can work like that also very strongly.
Yeah. I can relate to it. So when I first started doing these interviews, my nature is I'm quite a shy person.
Mm-hmm.
But there was just a fire in me, the passion to do something. My partner and I were doing meetup groups, and I wanted to reach more people, so I decided to do the interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And I was quite often writing the questions out before.
Mm-hmm.
But then I found the conversations are quite often flat.
Yes.
Because it was all like pre-planned in many ways.
Yes.
And then the more I relaxed into just being with whoever I was speaking to. I'm actually quite nervous now. I think it's because I hold you in very high esteem, so I'm trying to relax out of that. But I've noticed with people who, when I'm more relaxed, I'll find questions arising.
Yeah.
That quite often I think, where did that come from?
Yeah.
And the response that often comes back is very powerful for the...
It's alive.
Yeah.
It's alive. That's what has happened because on whatever stage you might, even if you're feeling a bit anxious or whatever, because it's not coming from script.
Hmm.
It's alive, it's truth, it's in real time with the cosmos.
Hmm.
If you plan a speech, for instance, and you may be the best one at remembering things and so on, but when you deliver it, you're not in time.
Yeah.
And you're not really conversing with whoever is there because you didn't know them before.
No.
So you're only sort of talking at them.
Hmm.
And you don't be surprised people start walking out.
Mm.
We do see this from time to time in our travels, And also, very recently, we had one Skype with one country that is very, very... A lot of people are finding that our meetings, which we call satsangs, that they're finding them very, very engaging and they're very much following. And we planned a Skype satsang to meet, and there were hundreds of people came.
Mm.
And what happened, for some reason, it wasn't going. It was like, no, because when we meet, usually, it's just so fire, so beautiful. And this time, it wasn't going. And then I realized what had happened is that they decided to put a few different groups from the same country together and have some people waiting, and someone was orchestrating it. Someone said, okay, now you speak. And then after, then you speak.
Yeah.
And it was just tight.
No,
and I felt, no, this is dead. It's not flowing.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. It travels all the way through. Once you find that thread, that opening, it applies to every aspect of your life.
Mm.
Every aspect of your life is going to have that freshness, that spontaneity, that trust, that beautiful adventure of just exploring together and seeing what come up. than the other way, which is a bit fraught with fear. You know, there's a fear that, you know, like, I have to get it right down, I got to control it. But you'll never get that magic that comes when the spirit is open and it's just in real time with each other.
Yeah. Well, I see that in your satsangs. You just, for hours and hours, it's just spontaneous, fresh. There's no, like you say, you don't come with an agenda, a plan.
Yeah. No. That would just be, it was such a claustrophobic feeling to do that now.
Yeah.
There was a time when I think one of the first satsangs I was invited to share, because before that I was just meeting people in my house and like this, but I was invited to come and share satsang. And the first satsang took place in Dublin. And I remember sitting in my room and people were entering the hall next door. And I didn't realize there were going to be so many people. So, footsteps coming up, because it was actually the church. The church was here. And there was the choir boys' room, which was where the satsang was going to take place, the meeting was going to take place, and I had a room to the an adjacent flat to the church, you know, which they opened up, so you know, like this, so I could hear all the footsteps coming up, you know, coming up and going into the room. I got intimidated a bit, and I said, oh my God, you know, they're coming, they're going to expect me to say something. I don't have anything to say, and I said, oh. What can I talk about? And it was a panic, you know?
Yeah.
And I felt, you know, okay, I'll talk about desire and attachment. That's good. That's juicy, you know? So I went inside and then we met everyone and I was sort of like nervous, but I felt just a little bit confident. Okay, at least I got something for them. Mm. Greetings, everybody. Nice to meet you. Thank you for coming and for inviting me and everything like this. And perhaps today we'll start off with a little bit, maybe we can discuss, you know, one of the great human passions, you know, desire and attachment. And started talking. And like in 1.5 minutes, I had exhausted the subject, you know.
Yeah.
It was like this. And then because I started in this unusual way for me, there was nothing coming. I was not in line. There was no cue of things to come. It was just, I was back in open space again, and the people looking, and I thought, yeah, that's how you die. This is how you die. And so something just kind of came up, and somebody said, can I ask you about this thing? And then, yeah. But there was such a strong impact that I said, yeah, this is it. And that was the last time that ever happened. It was such a distasteful feeling. So, and right throughout life, in every aspect of our expression, everything is left. Everything must come from this emptiness.
Mm. And I see that just the times I've been around you.
And
watch your YouTube clips when people come to you with questions. It's just there's such a beautiful presence there. One thing, I spoke to a friend of mine a while ago, one of the psychologists who introduced me to this understanding, which led me to you.
Yes.
And I said, oh, I'm open to speak to Muji. And I said, what would you ask him if you could ask him a question? And bearing in mind this, I won't say his name, but this man is a very spiritual man himself.
Mm.
And I quoted, it's interesting you mentioned Ramakrishna, because I've been you mentioned the book.
The Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna.
And after I heard you mention that, I was bought that for Christmas about 2 years ago, and I've still not finished it. Normally I devour spiritual books, but this one, I open it and it punches me in the face and I have to put it down. You know, I can only take so much of it. Anyway, I'm digressing again.
No, you're not. You are right in line with the way that we are speaking. And I'm very comfortable with it.
So, I mean, but it's a beautiful book.
Yes,
it is. It's a beautiful book. Yeah. The language is sometimes a bit... I struggle with the woman and gold thing sometimes.
Yes.
It's a beautiful book. And I was speaking to this psychologist who I said I may speak to, and he said one of his favourite books is about Ramakrishna. So I think we're all on the same page. And in the three principles of psychology, they talk a lot. I mentioned before, I'm not going to go into the whole thing, but they talk a lot about thought. And Sydney Banks, he used the terms divine thought.
Mm-hmm.
And personal thought.
Yes.
He was referring to the ego.
Yes. Yeah.
And the person I'm talking about, he asked me to ask you about divine thought.
Yes.
He just asked me about divine thought.
Okay. I'm happy. We talked about personal thought, egoic thought,
yeah,
which comes out of the conditioning. When I say, I often use this expression, that when consciousness has painted a self-portrait of itself as a person,
mm,
and then it lives in that self-portrait as a person, which is also consciousness, but a much more condensed, much more contracted form of consciousness. And it is completely caught up in its own, in its own projection, its own self-image, its own selfishness, actually, and its own limited view of life, because greater than its limited view threatens it, actually.
Mm.
He needs to have this kind of way, you see. So he's also able to observe, but he's observing with self-interest all the time.
Mm.
So the observing is biased. So it hasn't come to what I call that the divine observing, which is impartial, impersonal. It means it's just seeing. It's not seeing and interpreting. It's just seeing. And when we talk about, like, now you use the term divine thought, and immediately something comes inside my heart. Divine thought is not about language. It's not about words, because we all, if you speak English, when a divine thought, it will come in English. It's not going to come in some, you know, you know, sort of like, you know, some other strange thing. It's just, so it's not the words, not the thought. Divine thought means that it comes without mind. It comes through inspiration. It comes totally, like, intuitively.
Mm.
And in a sense, it doesn't happen until it happens.
Mm.
It's not like it's a saved up thing. Yeah. And then it's waiting to say, okay, divine thought.
Mm.
It's just there, and it works with common thought, the flow of the mind that is searching for something. And it is, I would call it, you could call it wisdom,
mm,
also.
Yeah.
Mean that it is totally appropriate to the need of the moment.
Yeah.
It is totally there, not to impress, not to contest, but somehow to facilitate understanding. It comes from a much higher vibration than when human beings are talking with each other, coming from the same self-reference place.
Yeah.
Divine thought is totally spontaneous and intuitive.
Mm.
And but when it lands, it is not a stranger.
No.
It comes with a sort of a force that is, I would say, it is. Unchallengeable. It has that kind, you know, it just comes inside the heart, and it just creates an opening. It just creates opening. So it's not an argument.
No.
It's not an argument. So that would, what I would say, is that divine thought. It doesn't exist until it delivers itself.
Yeah. Comes from presence.
Yes, it arises out of presence, mm-hmm, like that. Yeah.
And I think I hear so many people report to you about, they come across you on YouTube, which is how I came across you.
Yeah.
And then they just can't help but watch you. I was, my partner and the children, they thought I was going insane. As soon as I finished work, I had my dinner, I was just watching your clips over and over again.
Uh-huh.
And to me, it seemed to me, because a lot of where you're coming from is that space.
Uh-huh.
I really, and I'm not just the only, well, all these people here today at this retreat, they recognize, they recognize that presence of where you speak from.
Yes.
And it's such a beautiful, beautiful. Even if people don't always necessarily grasp what you're saying, there's a resonance there, isn't there?
It's a good word you use. I use the word synchronicity or resonance.
Yeah.
It resonates. And I'd like to just speak a little bit more about this resonance, because very often in the classical way, we think we learn by studying things and stuff. And we do on some level, but is not as penetrative or pervading as when we come into an understanding through resonance or through synchronicity.
Yeah.
The other way of learning is very much with the mind, and the other is with the heart, like that. That somehow you begin to feel the just the vibration of being, and you're in synchronicity, you're in a state of love, actually, I would like to say like this. And in this kind of communication, this kind of communion, in a way, it's you reach a certain synchronicity. It's almost as though you are disembodied, but with a body. Mm. You know, you come into a sort of a higher altitude of consciousness,
yeah.
You know, which, and very naturally, you don't know how you know, just because you reach that, or you're in that space, and there's openness, so you can lift, something lifts up there. And in that space, actually, you come into that zone, what I call the God zone or the divine zone.
Yeah.
There's a word in Sanskrit, udmani. It means the state above the mind. Yeah. So those who are, you know, free of the egoic domination are living in this udmani state. It means that the state above the mind.
Yeah.
So all the sort of crossfire that comes with the usual thinking and the competitiveness and the challenge and stuff, it's just like in a lower realm, in a way.
Yeah.
And you don't get caught in that so easy.
Yeah.
Sometimes there may be still some of that virus is still in us, and it comes up and a few bullets fly, and you feel that, and you know that, you know, okay, you know, all right, so that has been experienced now, so it must be weaker next time, because you know, there's nothing to encourage that to proliferate in you to carry on. So this state of being is very much in synonymous with this vibration. When I say synchronicity, when we reach that level, then everything has become easy. It's like your understanding just seems to happen. It's like it's there already, and it's like a curtain has just been pulled on it, and it's just that you understand, and you just come to know, and it's not just in the feel of words, but your whole body language and your feeling of being, everything feels like it's just held into a kind of warm embrace of this kind of vibration.
Yeah.
I put that higher than the learning that just comes through the mind and through, you know, like that.
Yeah, it's too much put on intellectuals.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. Because when it happens in this vibration level, it radiates.
Yes.
It has a radiance, which the intellectual knowledge alone by itself does not have that.
Mm.
And that radiance is a communicative power. It communicates, it reassures those with whom you are engaging, and even not necessarily consciously, it reassures them that they're in a safe environment. When I say safe, I mean safe in a sense that they can trust it more.
Yes.
They come into a place of trust.
Yes.
And so it is in that vibrational field that sometimes people just start crying, because they may never have seen you physically, they have no record of this, but your vibration and what it enables in them to experience allows them to meet you as though you know, you've always known each other, and they trust you.
Mm.
I remember a few years ago, I had a dream. It was in London, and Zenji and another friend, Rani, was staying at the house. And I had this dream. And in the dream, I found myself walking along some rooftops, which you have in India, in some places, all these flat roofs, and sort of walking across roofs and stuff. And then I wanted to come down because the sun was a bit hot. And then I saw some steps, and I started going down these steps. And it just landed into a space. There was no roof in that space, but there was shadow caused by the steps. And I came down into this cooler space, like walking down in a pool with no water.
Mm.
And as I turned like this, Ramana Maharshi was sitting like on the floor, and like he was eating off some banana leaf or something, just eating. But he was just there, and he was looking at me, stood there. Now, in one instant, I knew and felt I'm in the presence of someone. I could never insult them on any level at all. Mm. They could not be hurt or disappointed with me about anything I do or have done or could do.
Mm.
And yet they were totally present, it hadn't spoken, and yet I was just inside this embrace of love, just by the vibration, you know? And it was so powerful, you know? And then I came into the room, and Zenji and Rani were sitting, and I said to them, you know, I have this most beautiful dream. And I told them what this dream was. And they said, that's how we feel with you. It was I said, really? But do you know how I felt? You see? It was such a beautiful feeling that I'm in the presence of someone, I could say, bottoms to you, or whatever it is, or, you know, or whatever. And it would just have, it would have absolutely no meaning, because it could not, it was like, that would be like throwing a stone while you're underwater, you know? It just would not go very far. It has nothing at all. And yet there's nothing in resistance to it, you know? It's this type of energy, which is in us, in all the beings, even the most disturbed one.
Yeah.
It's only in the mind. Only the mind is disturbed. And then the body can, of course, hold some of the energy of that disturbance. But ourself, it cannot be disturbed.
Yeah.
And this is the beautiful privilege, I can say, in my life, that this way of interacting with beings is to focus on that thing in them, which is always perfect.
Yeah.
It's just always perfect. Because if that was not there, if all we had was body, mind, and personality, we'd really be doomed.
Yeah.
Fortunately, we have this beautiful space.
There is another question I wanted to ask you. It's just gone out of my mind completely now. Well, firstly, let me just acknowledge what you said about when the guy said, "Oh, we feel like that about you." I've never really been. I think I said earlier when I was being dragged along to the yoga class, I've always been a very blokey bloke, and not easy to get emotional. But I remember the first time I saw you at Zuma a few years ago.
Yeah.
When you walked in the room, there was I felt that, you know, like a welling of emotion. I was quite shocked, even though I was looking forward to spending physical time with you at the retreat.
Yeah, yeah.
I was still shaken by the emotions that were brought up in there. And I heard people say that about Cindy Banks as well, who was the man that many psychologists learned from.
Uh-huh.
He just had a presence about him that,
yes,
an unknowing. A lot of the psychologists at first, they were a bit resistant. Not resistant is probably the wrong word. They didn't understand what he was saying.
They were cautious and hesitant.
But they knew he knew something. I think one of the psychologists that met him said it was like, at first, in the first encounter, it was like listening to an expert mechanic. So they had no idea what he was talking about.
Yeah.
But I knew he did.
Yes.
And I think that's what people are drawn to you with. And it's just come back to me now, what I want to ask you.
Yeah.
You talked earlier about levels of consciousness, and that's very much something that's talked about in the principles. And throughout the day, we can have a high level where we're being very loving, and then the next moment we can be nasty and irritable. And it's very helpful to recognize where you are in those.
Yeah.
Because most people are just, as we began the conversation, I won't keep you much longer. We were talking about how people are pulled this way and that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when people begin to, in the principles, they talk a lot about the thought feeling connection, that your feelings are giving you feedback on the quality of your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And at first I got a bit caught up on that, because I thought that would mean I could never be angry, but anger can come from a high place as well.
Yes.
I've seen you be quite, not angry, but I've seen, it's not always, wisdom isn't always
cute and sweet and soft.
I've seen you be quite firm with people when they come up to you and you're like, oh, not in a nasty way, but you're firm with people.
Yes.
I'm drifting all over the place now, you know. But what I've noticed, well, not notice, you're very frank about this. You don't want people, in your teachings, you don't want people just to be having momentary satoris or insights.
Yes.
You're guiding them to a place of being. May pick me up on my words if I'm not relating exactly how you would put it, but you're wanting them to be in that. You're saying that there's a possibility of being in that higher level of consciousness.
Yes.
Transcend. You can never rid yourself of the ego, is what you're saying, but you can transcend it.
Yes.
And you're saying that that's possible.
Transcending it is ridding yourself of it, actually, as well too. Yes. That higher state of consciousness is not something that we can do anything. It cannot be improved. It cannot be improved. It's just. I would even call it not so much a state, but a sort of stateless state. Mm. That within which other states may manifest, but itself. But they come. All states come and go. Mm. It does not come and go. Yes. And here is the paradox, because people then say, "But if it doesn't come and go, and if it's here all the time, why I don't know about it?" Yes. And this is at the very. This is the very crux of the entire exploration into truth, that, you know, I say it is here all the time, and very often during the day, your mind is immersed in it, but you're not conscious of it. Mm. But you say, if it is the bliss, of course I would be conscious of it. Then I would say, you know, you need to really be here for a little bit to recognize the thing which is unchanging in you. It is unchanging, it is totally whole, complete. You are not conscious of it, because at the moment you got your head in the balloon of your ego, and you got the ego helmet on, which is it's just, you know, you believe the noise and the thing you have in your own little submarine, and you're not able to see with your heart at the moment. Doesn't mean it's not there. And the whole of it is about becoming conscious of it, because as you become conscious of it, it means that you become less conscious and less involved in all the noise that is being produced through the mind and through the false identity. Mm. That is the important thing. And so coming to this higher state of consciousness, it's, you know, I say it's here all the time, you see. But the consciousness, having identified itself as a person, lives in a world of its own perceiving. It's like it lives in a world, like just like some people, they're in a world that's inside the greater world. You know, you're like, we're living in a world inside the world. You got your own world, you got your own friends and stuff, and you have fights and stuff and all kind of stuff happening in this. But you're in a bigger world where there's joy and peace also, but it's not accessible to you, because your world is so defined and confined by the limits of your own tight identity.
Yeah.
You see, like this.
Yeah.
So that has to break open. It has to be opened up. And you, which is the consciousness, in a state of hypnosis, in believing that it is the person that it imagines itself to be, and cannot hear these words well, because it won't admit that it is imagined, that it's imagining any self. He said, but this is what I am. He said, I'm imagining myself. You're the one who is imagining it. You see, it cannot, you see. So this is where it fails to try and convince people. Grace has to begin acting on them already. And by that I mean, every human being has grace. So the grace I'm talking about is to do with the timing of the universe. Because you may be much more in touch with this, with yourself, but not to the extent that you allow the universe to show you, rather than thinking that you know who needs help and when they need help. Mm. So what happens is timing. And when here inside me is not, I'm not on a mission, I'm not recruiting, I'm not advertising, I just am. Yes. Then somehow in my field of movement, encounters arise as much as a surprise for me, because I'm not targeting anybody. Mm. It doesn't work. Then somehow the life unfolds, that someone comes and starts to talk to you, because That kind of meeting has already been arranged by nature somehow, mm. on some level. Mm. And it means that you will still have to move with a sensitivity. It doesn't mean that anything is in your pocket. It means that you're moving with a sensitivity. And that sensitivity is, I would call it worship, in fact. Mm. Meaning that there's a great respect for the being in whose presence you are sharing something. Mm. And with the timing of the God timing inside, all your language, your movement, everything is somehow moving from there. Mm. And so at the same time, you may be pointing something and expressing something to guide someone. You're also learning in some way. Yeah. You're also, you know, maturing in your own sensitivity and maybe a different thing, maybe in a much more subtle way. And maybe there it's in a different way. But I said a number of times, consciousness does not waste any of its expression. Yeah. Every part of it is used somehow. Mm. And we can't always use our minds to kind of to pinpoint where that is, and nor do we need to do that. Mm. Because there's a trust in us that reveals things in a way that the mind will not easily agree with, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, because of our conditioning and our own private mythologies or whatever it is. Mm. Get in the way of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I like when you talk then about the consciousness doesn't waste any of its expression.
Yeah.
I remember, I can look back on some of the periods in my life where I labelled as bad periods, you know.
Yes, yeah.
And now I can see how there was so much learning that came from them.
Yeah.
Times of depression, times of... And I can see now it was just all part of the bringing me to this point here. Now,
yes.
You know? And it's just so interesting.
Yeah.
You begin to see that that's... It's not just a nice idea, it really is true.
Yes, and we can't really disagree with it, actually, because if we look back, we see that these are the experiences you would never have chosen by yourself.
No, definitely.
Isn't it? You know? And we just see that we don't really grow in that type of depth by lovely, sweet experiences. Yeah. So life brings it, and then for a while, depending upon how much we are governed by our own thinking, rather than from inspiration or from the deeper self, then we tend to gravitate towards more pleasant experiences, mm. to value them, pursue them more like that. Mm. And those experiences that shake you up, that step on your foot, throw you over the bridge or something, you know, we kind of feel like, you know, that was really horrible. Those are horrible times of my life. But as we grow in wisdom, you know, sometimes your appreciation of something happened 5 years ago is only now just helping you more powerfully, because it helped you anyway, but that help you have not noticed, you have not acknowledged. Mm. You know, it helped because maybe you just stopped doing that type of thing.
Yeah.
But the mind labeled it that was a bad experience. And so you didn't acknowledge your growth through it.
Mm.
But, you know, where can we stop? Because on every level, you know, the growth is taking place, the maturing is taking place, and so on. And you feel it also. You feel it. You cannot contest it.
Yeah. And I know, and I just came to mind that some of the people who, the understanding that I first came across, has been taken into prisons.
Yeah.
And people who are in dire situations, lost their children, women in prison who lost their children through addictions and one thing and another, then picked up this understanding and now gone out and are helping others in the same situation.
Yes.
Just, and without that low point, they wouldn't have been in that position, which now is they're in a beautiful position of really helping people on a soul.
Very much so. And they are the real soldiers in many respects, I would say this, because they've come through the mill, they've come through the grind, you know, and they have an integrity, a grit, a potency there. Because it's not just come, you know, just through the pages of a book or something. It's come through sort of like hard grafting, if you want to put it like that, you know. And it comes with a lot of experience also, you know, a lot of pain behind it. But the pain has been converted into a kind of compassion and a sort of empathy with beings who, you know, who can relate to that, who can relate to them. And, I mean, there's so much wisdom in life. There's so much compassion. There's so much power that, you know, we will never catch up with it, you know, because it is always in streams undiscovered. We are living on one stream like this, but there's an underground stream somehow that we never see, you know, and it actually supplies water to the top stream and guides even its flow. But you never see this stream because it's the heart stream. We are just for a long time in the mind stream like this, you know. And so you at a certain point you just develop a lot of gratitude for life in all of its expressions, you know. Even the physical one also, you know, for the physicality of being and the appreciation for the senses and to appreciate hard times. Yeah. And see that, you know, to not include them in the grand picture is to your detriment in some way, because then you'll always feel disappointed and let down. But you say, no, this is here also, you know, and you lose the fear of it, you know?
Yeah. I almost forgot that on my way here,
on your bike.
Trying to get here, yeah. But with the help of Shri and some of the team, they were gently coaxing me, not pushing me over. They were advising me to get quiet. I was so busy in my mind.
Yeah.
One last question, if you don't mind. I've said to you before, I really hold you in high esteem. Mm-hmm. And at one point, there's been this, I think I heard somebody mention this at the last event, not the last event, because I saw you in November as well.
Gotcha.
But the Z-Man, they talked about the guru trip, the dangers of the guru trip.
Gotcha.
I'm very open-minded about this. I see I think in the Western world, there's the... For example, in the Eastern understanding, they talk about bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotion. Mm-hmm. There's many paths.
Yes.
I would just wanted to know your views on the importance of a guru.
Acha.
Sorry to interrupt. Because there's so many fears of false gurus, isn't it? And I suppose it's how does a person know?
Yeah.
I just know in my heart when I'm with you that I'm in the right place.
Yeah.
And so there's that difference, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know somebody who's...
Yeah. There's a saying that you get the guru that you deserve. You know, there's a saying like this, you know?
Okay.
Because some people, just like life, you come in, you have a lot of inexperience, maybe a lot of selfishness. But you want to have the best romance in the world.
Mm.
You understand?
Yeah.
But you have to grow in maturity to kind of to meet and enjoy that and to flower in that. And I feel that even a bad guru is good for you on some level.
Yeah.
Because maybe you have a lot of projections about someone that they have to be like this and whatever. And as you come to grow into real understanding, then you see that that was helpful for you, but maybe now it's not longer any helpful for you.
Mm.
And then something inside knows it's time to move on or something. You still will learn from that. I think any as wisdom comes into the heart more or comes from the heart more, you will begin to recognize much more easily rather than decide.
Mm.
You just come to know that the time has come to move on or something. Mm. You ask what is the role of a guru in life or so. I think I've been very, very fortunate because myself also, I didn't know much about anything about guru and all of that. I was brought up in a very Christian environment. When I say very Christian, I mean like everybody, like in Jamaica, we are known to also be one of the most violent little countries around, but at the same time, there's nobody who don't believe in God. You know what I mean? So stuff. You know? These kind of contradictions are on the earth, I have to say. And very much, although I was brought up in this culture, I only can say that I met God in 1987.
Hmm.
You understand? That I can say, yeah, that was the experience. I always believed. We've always prayed. We always felt good. I've been touched many times in my heart. And we go to church and I felt... After church, I felt, you know, like this, that I've just been spring cleaned and just feel really high and just feel nice. But this time, I felt, I met God, you know, it's just like this now. Yeah. And for a while, I was with the little church that through which I'd come to know through this person who brought this, who facilitated this experience for me. But I was not comfortable there after a while. I felt that... I was not relating so much to the preacher there. I felt he was very much for and against, and very much against Muslims, and I couldn't relate to that, you know. So I at some point I felt that I just left the space, but I knew God was already here. So I was really searching for meeting people who could who were in some affinity with what I was having inside, but not in the context of saying, oh, I'm a Christian and so you must believe in this and so on. I always felt Christ's spirit inside my heart anyway, that this kind of we call it the kind of Pauline Christianity, which is of Paul, the Apostle Paul's way of speaking through not the four Gospels, but after the four Gospels, created, I call what is called the Christian trend of today, in a way, no? I was looking, and then I discovered Ramakrishna. I first saw Ramana Maharshi, but I had a bit of a withdrawal thing from that, and I found Ramakrishna, and I started reading Ramakrishna. And I also was consuming Ramakrishna, actually. I mean, although his language was not what I was used to, like Mother Kali and all this type of stuff. But inside that, there was a great correspondence with my heart. In fact, I didn't really want it to finish. The more I was coming towards the end, I was kind of backing up and reading something over. I didn't want to come to the end of it. But I had the feeling to go to India. I knew he was not in the body, but it was so beautifully written, this account by Mahendranath Gupta, that I just felt like I want to go and sit in his room. I want to touch his slippers and all this kind of stuff. But I didn't get there. While in Rishikesh, what happened was that one day coming up from the Ganges, a car stopped. Do you know Rishikesh?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, of course. Yes. At the top of Laxmanjula, okay. As you come up from the bridge. Right. There's a little plateau there where sometimes there are cars there. And beyond that, you can't go with cars. Well, I was at that point coming up from the Ganga with some local friend and some friends, and a car was stopped there. This is in 1993. And they were calling to ask for directions or something. There was an Indian driver, and then turned out there was a couple of people in the back. And they were talking to one of my friends to ask him about something. But I stayed with the two other friends, a Greek couple. And then the man looked out and said, "Hey, you remember me? I know you, I remember you." But he wouldn't say my name. So I said, no, because I've not been in India long.
Yeah,
I said, a lot of people with beards. No, I thought that, a lot of people with beards, and I'm sure a lot of people look like me. So I said, no. And he goes, "Oh, man, hey. And then another face looked out from the back seat, and it was a woman. And she said, "Yeah, hey, is that man?" And we got laughing a little bit. I said, no, it's just somebody looks like me. The friends were saying that you've got a double in India and all this thing. And then the driver looked over and goes, "Yes, I know you. Like, and so we started laughing. I said, no, you don't, man. You really don't. I've just been here from here." And they said, "Wow, it's amazing. I just can't believe it. Where are you staying?" And all this type of stuff. So anyway, they drove off. And I kept walking up to my hotel, which is at the top of Laxmanjula. When I got there, the same car was parked there. And they were just checking in. And I was walking to the same hotel. They said, "You stay here?" I said, "Yeah." They said, "We're just checking in. And hey, let's have dinner." And I felt very uncomfortable because I don't like to be pulled into this type of thing. Yeah. But just to be polite, I said, okay. And I came down and sat with them. We ate together. And then they say, you know, our master comes to this place. Used to live here a long time ago. And we came here because it's still his favorite place, Rishikesh. And we just came here for the day. We're going back tomorrow. "Have you not heard of Papaji?" And Papaji, no, I don't know Papaji. "Oh, hang on a second." She went off and got this book, like Wake Up and Roar or something, and came back, "This is Papaji." And I sort of looked at him. I wasn't attracted to him, So looked, and I sort of opened the book, flicked through a little bit, and okay, nice. It looks really nice and so on. And then we said goodnight. I said, "Listen, we're going back tomorrow to Lucknow. Why don't you come with us?" It turned out that the driver was also not a taxi driver. It was okay. They were together. So when he come back tomorrow, I said, because I had a feeling I wanted to stay in Rishikesh more, you know. And then I said, I don't know. I think I think about it, sleep on it, and let us know in the morning. They were Americans actually.
Okay.
And the next morning, they came in the morning on the door. Hey, you coming? You want to come? You want to come? I said, you know what? Give me the address, and I'll come. Mm. I'll come. I was very touched by them because they were so much pride. They seemed so happy. They were so full of life. And I said, give me the... But I just thought I didn't want to travel with them because I wouldn't like it. You know, they'd all be talking all the time and stuff.
Too noisy American.
Yeah. Risha and Rishi. They were a couple. And I don't remember the Indian driver's name. And then after this, they left. And when they left, I suddenly felt lost. I thought, what am I doing in Rishikesh? I should have gone with them like this. And I stayed 2 more days in Rishikesh. By that time, I just had to leave. And you had to leave. I had to leave. I went to Varanasi for 2 days, to Haridwar. And then from there, I went to Varanasi. I went to Varanasi for 10 days because I had a strong... That was the only other place I knew about. Yeah. I went there for 10 days. And after 10 days, I had a feeling, you know, I want to go and see this Papaji or Pundraji. And these friends came with me, and I went there. And I went up, and I went to satsang. And when he came in the room, I felt something very powerful in the room. I just felt like, it's like superhuman or something. Also, I never seen an Indian so tall, you know. I walked in, I just felt such a strong presence with him. And he was the first guru who I'd sort of met. I don't know any other guru like this. And I stayed with Papaji then for about 4 months, 4 or 5 months. And just in his presence, something just so powerful took place for me. That was the second great change in my life. It's the second great, you know, kind of encounter. And I didn't go around from place to place at all. I was just with Papaji. Then I left from Papaji and I went down to Ramana Ashram and I met Sri Yogi Ram Surat Kumar, who I just love. We just got on very well. And Ma Devaki, who is his closest devotee. And they are the only ones I really have met and just been with them. So all the things I heard about gurus and this type of thing, I just knew in my heart that, you know, of course, there are going to be some people who have got it in the mind, or they got other things. I don't know. I don't really go there, you know, because I was blessed to meet the Buddha. I felt it was enough for me, and I knew it. I didn't have to compare him with anybody else. I just knew that it was, you know. But although for the first part of my meeting with him, I just held him at bay because I just felt you know, I'm not ready for this. But he first brought the wind of this infiniteness. Before, I just felt I was, me and God was in this house. And God was everywhere as well too. But when I met Papaji, I became aware of the limitless and the infinite. I actually felt like I was in the infinite, you know, through his presence, something I started to feel this. I had not heard of it before. It was like, I had not heard of this. And there was just this infinite kind of, I couldn't touch any edge that I could reach the edge of it. Mm. And so that was what started to come. And then after I really met him, and then there was that. So you asked your question is what do I feel is the importance of a guru? I feel one is very fortunate if one comes to meet a being whose presence brings stillness in your mind. But it need not be like that. It can also be that your mind becomes very shaken up.
Yeah.
But underneath that, or inside that being shook up, there's a deeper awareness inside that that it's a blessing of some sort, you know? Not like, wow, the guy really disturbed me. It really is more like you're shook up and you know that there's something bigger than you.
Yeah.
That is shaking you up.
Yeah.
Like that. Either that or you're in the presence and your mind feels immediately still. And if you feel any of those feelings, I would say stay in that company until you feel that something compels you to leave, whether that is from your mind or whatever it is. But I would stay with that and draw as much as you can from that association as much as possible. Because these masters, they are so different in their expression. But they bring you to that single reality within. And a true master is never asking worship from anybody.
No.
And they're not asking for adoration. They don't want anything from you. They really don't want anything. Mm. If it's a true master, he doesn't want anything. He doesn't want it, anything. He doesn't want food from you. Doesn't want service from you. Doesn't want love from you. He doesn't even really want you to be liberated in any overstrong way. Mm. It's just like the river doesn't ask you to drink.
Yeah.
You can just come.
Yeah.
But there's a power in their presence that must correspond to something in you and to bring these seemingly two things together. And that's all I would want to say about what the term guru. For me, the term guru is a very beautiful term because it means the one who dispels darkness.
Yes.
And darkness, a metaphor for ignorance. Yes. It doesn't mean the giver of light. It says removing the darkness or, removing the darkness. The light that is naturally in you will shine by itself. And I found that to be not a displeasing way to express what I've felt. And I've been very lucky, I feel, to meet someone also like Yogi Ram Suratkumar, who was a Siddha yoga, yogi, who was, they called him the godchild of Tiruvannamalai. He always referred to God as father, and he always referred to himself as the beggar, basically. So whenever they want, if people come and say, oh, please help me. He says, why you ask this beggar for anything? I'll leave this beggar alone. And he was that. I just loved him. I loved his presence. I love Ma Devaki, who is still there, and we are very close. And for others, I don't know. I don't know what they do. I don't know. People say, what's the guru? I don't know. I don't know anything at all. People, all I can say is, if someone is as a hurt for truth or liberation, I'm quite attracted to them.
Mm.
Not because they say that, because people have said that and I've not felt anything, but because I feel that there's a possibility with them inside.
Mm.
And something is just naturally, I feel like in service to that, a joyful service to that.
Mm.
And I don't think much more need to be said about that.
Mm. Your passion is obvious for the people who have come to this wonderful retreat. The passion you have for sharing and helping and guiding people is more than apparent.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't create this passion. I didn't create that. You know, it's something that it is just there. It has just come. You know, it has just come like that. And it grows stronger in some way, not stronger as a passion, but stronger as a force. It doesn't stronger. I don't ever feel like I have a passion, so, but it grows stronger as a force and becomes much more naked, because much in the way that I've been sharing changes over time also, and without my deliberate intention, it just grows like this, and becomes more strict as I become less interested in people. Well, I was never interested in people's stories, actually. I was just more patient with it and allowed more of that. And now it's just less patience for that. And just, you know, hit that. But only if they are able to come at that speed. I don't rush.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to kick, you know, but I try to work with somehow. It's not true. I don't try to work. It happens spontaneously, actually. If someone can only absorb at a certain speed, somehow I find that I'm in tune with them and we can go at that speed.
You know, to slow down to meet them.
Yeah. You know, I was hesitating to say, I know, because it's not like the sound of saying, I know, feels like something I know from beforehand.
Yeah.
But I only find out in the moment, which is what's so beautiful about.
I've seen that in satsang, where you can be very gentle with one person.
Yeah.
And the very next person, you're...
Yeah.
It's full on, you know.
Yes. Yeah, it just seems to happen quite spontaneously.
Yeah.
And there's nothing personal to them. It's just, you know, that's what's needed. And like that. So,
Shrimuji. I won't keep running on that. I feel very blessed to have had this opportunity to speak with you. Thank you. I feel blessed to have met you in my life as well.
Yes, thank you, thank you, thank you. And I have to say that, you know, it's funny because I had an interview before this, you know, and it was quite nice. Some questions were presented, already written out, and we went through them, and I felt the questions were very good. But this I enjoy. You understand? I enjoy because it's alive, and I can feel you, and you know, I sometimes say, why is he keep, maybe it's just some, he's just polite, and he says things like, you know, no, I'm I don't want to take up too much of your time. I said, no, I'm enjoying it. It's very good, and you know, it's I'm very happy you came, and come on, give me a hug. So good luck. So good. So wonderful. So wonderful. Can we take a picture together?
Yeah, I think that. Oh, okay,
then. It's too dark. It's too dark. Outside here? Yeah. It is like that. Okay. Oh. Oh yeah. The evening is closing down, no? A bit, and. Okay. Yeah. Is enough light like this? Very good. Very good. Thank you. Oh, you want to stay till the end?
Oh, yes.
Okay, good.
The 2 days before were a learning in itself. Like you said, there's no wrong, good or bad. It was all a...
Yeah. It was an up and down, huh?
Yeah. Well, up into the... I said to Sri earlier, I was getting the gold thing. Ramakrishna was getting to me about the cost of the bike, and I need to just go back to work. And I was at the bus stop, and I had a choice to go to Faro or go back home. And I didn't even know it was going, and it just came out of Faro, out of my mouth. Yeah. I didn't make the decision, it was made for me. That's how it felt.
This is very good. We're happy that you found that decision, that recognition. So good.
Well, I'll take you back down, Mark.
Thank you.
I'm so happy I got to be here for the interview also.
Oh, good. So good.
Very enjoyable.
Yeah, it was very nice, very alive. I heard Guruji speaking about some things I've never heard him speak about before.
That's what comes out when you know you don't have an overplanting, and some things can emerge like that. Very good.
Thank you.
See you in the wedding. So good. Thank you, darlings. Thank you. Yeah, give it to Jaya.